This is Mae Warren. Today is the 6th of November, 1996. I'm in McLean, Virginia, with Jeff Laborde, who is actually a legendary figure at Washington at this point. And I want to just cut right to the chase and get the story about why you were infamous. Maybe not by name, but...
Sure, certainly. Not by name, more by looks. Or
not by name, but right. But it's just a story that is well-known at WNL. And you're
more well-known than I thought, actually, or now I realize.
Well, tell me what the truth is. Tell me the story. Tell me what happened.
Well, I guess... My deep voice.
No, you're fine.
Okay. It was my sophomore year, which, the winter of my sophomore year, which was, I guess, when Pledship was supposed to have started in January, so of would have been in 1993. And it was towards the end of Pledship. And traditionally, we had always had stories passed down to us within the fraternity. I was an SAE. You may not want to mention that. I'm not sure. Just, it's a story in and of itself. I don't know if it needs fraternity affiliation, but we had had stories passed on us about how towards the end of Pledship, before, you know, things wrapped up, the freshman pledge class usually was encouraged to kidnap a sophomore. And
why a sophomore?
Because the sophomores were the next level, and they liked to think that they were still a full part of the house, but the juniors and seniors always... To them, they were still freshmen, if you know what I mean. And not only that, but the sophomores were usually much more involved in Pledship because they were hands-on. It was their first time as actives. And so the freshmen knew them a lot better. And so they got to pick different ones that they had certain feelings about. And let's see. So as the Pledship wore on, we would tell them the same stories that we had heard about people being kidnapped in the past, where nothing really outstanding. I think the only one that I ever really heard of was like 3 or 4 years before myself, where a guy had just gotten a pilot's license, so they kidnapped an active and flew this guy to the middle of nowhere, dropped him off on the tarmac, turned the plane around, and took right back off. And they were told, you know, I think the unsaid rule was that if the pledges drop you off and they come back and they beat you back from wherever they take you back to the campus, then you can't really get back at them. You know, they've accomplished their challenge, and so they get off scot-free. Whereas otherwise, then you know, then they're your kind of, they're your pledges again, and you get to have all your pledge rights with them as a class, I guess.
If you get back first.
And so that was, like I said, really the only story that I could remember. There were a couple of other ones where, you know, that I'd heard from other fraternities where they had taken guys down to Hollins, I think, was one good one, where they chained a guy to a tree in front of the Hollins dorms and took off all his clothes. And luckily I didn't have anything quite embarrassing, but it was still pretty interesting when my year rolled around. When I was a freshman, we kidnapped a guy, and they had frightened us so much by saying, you know, you better leave us alone, you better not mess around with us, or else we'll get you guys, that we just picked one guy up and then drove him out to the country and made him walk home, you know, nothing too special. But my year, they had, the pledges were a lot bigger than a lot of the guys in the house, if I remember correctly, or some of the guys in the house. So there's a little more intimidation. Some of them were pretty renowned for being pretty extreme, like in the martial arts and stuff.
And when you say bigger, you mean physically bigger or more in number?
More in number. Okay. We only had, I think, 15 or 16 guys in the fraternity, and there were 23 guys or 24 guys in that class. And let's see. So we rolled around, and we kind of got a feel. My roommate and I had been warned by a couple of the guys in their class who we were good friends with that we were going to be targeted, so we were watching out for these guys because they only had like a week in which to do it, so we were keeping an eye out. And we did things like, I think the night before, it actually worked out really well. We went up to the freshman parking lot and let the air out of the freshman cars, their tires, so that they wouldn't be able to use their cars to take us anywhere. They actually got around that. So it came up almost to the day where they really could the window of opportunity for them was about to close. And it was a Friday afternoon after a big snowstorm, and everyone was heading out to Windfall, which is one of our big party houses, and it has a big hill, and everyone was going out there sledding. And I was in my last class on the hill that Friday afternoon, and I was heading back out there. And I was sitting there in the middle of class. I'd actually gone to a class later than the one I usually do. It was a Dr. Futch class, actually, a history class. And one of the freshmen walked in, one of my freshman pledges, walked into the class and stuck his head around. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, and I was kind of like, what is going on? Closed the door, walked back out, and then didn't think anything of it. But I should have thought something of it. Because as the bell rang, I got up and I was walking out of class. And, you know, obviously the last place I ever would have thought to have worried about being kidnapped was from the hill. And obviously they put their finger on that too. And as I was walking out of class, I walked about 20 feet out of Newcomb Hall, turned out of one of the side doors, turned around and noticed that there were two of my freshman pledges coming out of the door right behind me. And I turned around and I saw two coming around the corner right towards me. And then all of a sudden, I don't know if I would consider myself paranoid or not, but something clicked. And I decided that I'd better get out of there. So I turned rapidly to walk towards the colonnade when I think about two or three more guys came out. And by that time, the two behind me had kind of hustled up and were right on me. And they didn't have smiles on their faces. They were determined. They had this, like, you know, glow in their eye. And it was like a lamb going to the wolves, you know. And they physically, jumped on me, grabbed me, and I kind of started swinging around, you know. I didn't yell or anything because I figured if I could get away quickly, you know, nothing would be made of it. And so I struggled, but, and it was right as the classes were letting out, so there were hundreds of people everywhere. And I remember some of my friends saying that they were walking out of the library and they saw me being carried like a coach who had just won a football game, except I didn't have the same look of happiness on my face. Back towards, I think, the registrar center, and they had one of my pledge brothers' cars there, which they had borrowed, and he had said, I'll loan it to you, but you have to promise me that you won't use it to, you know, kidnap anyone, and they said, sure, but they obviously broke his trust on that, and they threw me in the back of the car with a couple of other bigger guys with the engine running. And then they, like, taped up my hands and my legs and put a blindfold on me and drove me around town for a little bit, you know, having fun, saying all kinds of things that they were going to do to me and stuff. And then they turned around and threw me in the back of the trunk. And we...
In the trunk.
Well, it was a Jeep. It was like one of those Wagoneers.
Uh-huh.
In the back, where, you know, back behind the middle seat. It's just a big open space. So they threw me back there, and then there were a bunch of bags and coats and stuff back there, and they kind of just covered me up. And after about an hour driving around town, messing around, I think stopping to visit people and pick up people and tell people what the plans were and stuff, we just took off driving. Got on the interstate, drove forever, drove like, you know, six and a half hours. And I'm sitting there cramped up, you know, just getting all kind of... And you'll say the anticipation is building, not knowing where I was going, you know, even with whom at that point, other than that they were freshmen. They were told that they could never do anything to whoever they kidnapped, that they hadn't been done to them, so I knew I was pretty relatively safe as far as that goes. So we get somewhere, we stop, they pick up someone else who I had never heard his voice before in my entire life, and they took us to some place. I could tell it was in the middle of nowhere when they pulled me out of the car. And it was one of the guys had a country house, and they had taken me all the way down to Savannah, Georgia, which is where this guy lived. And he was a pledge, and he had a friend who was an SAE at another school who he was really good friends with. And this guy was even more gung-ho and even more psychotic. Supposedly he was a Navy SEAL or something like that. And so they pretty much had their fun with me, you know, doing messing around, mind games and stuff like that, till probably I'd say about 4:30 in the morning. And, you know, they had been drinking the whole time. It was only five guys, too, five pledges. And in my mind, they were the five pledges who deserved least to be able to get, you know, any kicks out of this, because, you know, they were the five worst pledges, according by our book. The rest of the pledges, I came to find out, were supposed to make it down there, but they couldn't because both their cars had multiple flat tires. So I did save myself a little bit of trauma in that sense. But so about 4:30, they pulled me out of this guy's house and put me back in the back of the Jeep. And they, you know, they at this point, they really hadn't told me anything about what was going on. I mean, I knew that they only had, you know, like I said, that window. It was the weekend. They had to be somewhere. I think they had their last study hall Sunday night, and this was Saturday morning early. So I knew that they couldn't mess around with me for too long. And let's see. So they had said that they were going to take me by boat to an island. I had guessed by that point who they were and where we were.
Were you still blindfolded?
I was still blindfolded the entire time. And, my hands were bound and my feet were still bound. And I had guessed where we were just purely based on, I don't really know, I guess because of the guy who is the quote-unquote ringleader was the guy who was, you know, I figured he was the ringleader and realized where he lived and just kind of, and that this guy who they had brought in was his friend. And so we went on, and they proceeded to tell me about how I was going to be able to, how they were going to make sure that they beat me back and how they weren't going to have to worry about it. So they were going to drop me off on this island. They said, you know, we're going to take you off the coast by boat, and it's a big cemetery. You know, it's not too far off coast. And they have a boat that comes out there once every 2 days, and there's a caretaker, and he comes and cleans things up and stuff. And so he'll either be out there, later on today or tomorrow. So don't worry about it. You know, you'll be safe. We'll give you enough clothes. Don't worry about it. In the meantime, I think I forgot to say earlier on, they had taken my wallet, my checkbook. I think they had given me back my ID, identification card, just to make sure, you know, if anything happened. And I think they had given me back my check. No, they had taken my checkbook. And so I really was left with almost no means if that was the case. So they take me to a marina, put me on the front of a boat, and we just kind of go. And we're driving along, you know, I can feel the wind, obviously tell that I'm on a boat. And we just keep on going, still blindfolded the whole time. They had uncuffed my, or unbound my hands and my feet, so just in case anything happened, I would only be blindfolded, so they said. They put a life preserver on me or something like that. And so we're driving, and they're gunning the motor and going slower and faster, talking about how the tide's coming in, so they wanted to be careful not to get stuck. Again, all for psychological value, you know. We finally come to a stop, I can tell, and they're like, okay, stand up, you know, you're going to jump, and there's only going to be about 2 or 3 feet of water. And at this point, I was just like, forget it, you know, I don't care, just get me out of here, let me off the boat. So I kind of took that leap of faith and landed in water that was about up to my knees, and they were like, you know, just walk forward. Because the blindfold was such that it was taped, so I could either stand there in water up to here for about, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, for as long as it would take to get the blindfold off, or walk on up to the beach. So I, you know, jumped in the water, and as I was unraveling, I was walking up to the beach, and I think I fell, and it was into the sand and kind of mud on my way up because I tripped over like a rock or a tree. Wasn't that cold though, luckily, down there. And so I got the blindfold off, turned around, looked, you know, it was still dark, sun was barely coming up, and I saw their boat heading away, and it looked like a river. It didn't really look like an island. If it was an island, it looked like there was only about 100 yards separating, you know, the land. And I walked up after I got the blindfold off, and walked up onto the beach and saw them. And this was really the kind of where I guess I started getting, I guess one of the things that the entire night that was a source of comfort for me was the fact that while I had been in the trunk of this guy's car, or in the back of this guy's car, I had realized that they had taken my wallet and all that stuff, and so I knew that I was going to have no way to get back, and that no one up at the house was going to wire me anything. So in the 6.5 hours that I had hid back there, I started messing around in the bags, looking for some means of sustenance, just in case such a situation should present itself, which it obviously did. And so I had smuggled some financial means from one of their wallets into my my shoe, you know, obviously with the full intent of reimbursing them once I you know, it was just a loan in my mind just to make sure that I could get back, since they had actually taken my wallet and whatever was in there. I wanted a little collateral. And so I got off the boat and dug around in my shoe, which is where I'd hidden it, and pulled it out, and actually walked through this cemetery. It was a big cemetery. I walked up off the beach, cemetery everywhere. It took me about half an hour to figure out that it was really just a river, and that they had just dropped me off on a bank south of town, I think it was, in the cemetery. So I walked through the cemetery out to a road, and hitched a ride with a guy who had been selling pipes or something like that. And he was really upset because I'd just fallen, and you know, it was cool, but it wasn't very cold out that morning. And I mean, you'll say I probably didn't look too good after being up for the past 24 hours. And he was just kind of like, you know, once I told him, we're just doing a fraternity thing, it was a big mistake. He just, you know, this damn fraternity pranks. I mean, I shouldn't, you know, we should go report this to the police, you know, going on and on about all this stuff. And so I finally calmed him down and got him to drop me off at a hotel in town. So when I was there, I walked in to the hotel and checked in to the hotel and got my clothes washed because they were all muddy and whatnot and wet. And took a nap, got some food, called and found out there was a flight from Savannah to Atlanta, and then I could get a connection from Atlanta back to Roanoke. And I figured that these guys wouldn't be able to turn right back around and head out because they were pretty, you know, inebriated, I think, from the previous evening, and Neil say very tired. So I called a cab, and the flight was at like 12, and flew back on the flight back to, and then had some of my fraternity brothers pick me up, and we drove back up, and you know, they're like, oh, well, so tell us the whole story, what's going on? But all of this was done based on those financial means that I had secured previously. So that was pretty gratifying in the sense that, you know, if this race was going to be done, and I had been embarrassed by being caught, you know, which is half the battle anyway. I mean, how was I going to save face, which is always a concern, especially when you have two classes above you, you know, willing to make fun of you for one thing. And then one class below you willing to make fun of you because they caught you. So this was, for me, kind of a big salvation. And so I got back, and we had actually, out of coincidence, planned to have a big fraternity party that night at the house. So I took a nap, cleaned up. And the party was in the fraternity house, and I went downstairs and sat right by the door of the party. And, you know, people started filing in, and I have never seen so many faces that you could tell they were just so happy to see me. They were so, I mean, I'm trying, I guess my sarcasm may not be picked up on the tape, but the looks of amazement that I got from these faces, the double takes that I got as they were walking in the door is unbelievable. And needless to say, the word had, from these freshmen that had not been able to go, but the freshmen who had been down there hadn't even made it back yet. And I was back, looking good as new, sitting right there with a big grin on my face, knowing that, you know, I had won the bragging rights, you know, gotten back in time. And as they're all soon to find out, you know, gotten back on their own means, essentially. And so, I, you know, it was a night of just telling stories over and over again. The word, I'm sure, got around like wildfire. And then the other guys got back the next day, and they were just, you know, I mean, what could they say, really? I talked to the guy who had kind of been the ringleader for the whole thing many, many times, and we're good friends to this day, and he still to this day, he said, I'm just so bitter, I'm, you know, upset with you, in a good way, of course, but that, you know, I thought we were going to cap things off, and I thought we were going to be the ones who had the bragging rights just forever, and you topped us, you know, and so it resolved, you know, everything was said and done, and we had a pretty good time. We all had a good story to tell, and we all got something out of it. And in the end, he actually, I think, you know, we took house funds and reimbursed them all for the expenses of my getting back. So it was, you know, no hair off anyone's chest. And like I said, it was definitely a story that we kind of knew that we'd kind of expand on itself, as I'm sure it has.
Yeah.
No, actually, the story I heard is the story you just told.
Oh, well, good.
That is amazing. I was fully prepared for it to be quite a different story.
Oh, really?
But
okay.
Isn't that interesting that you're...
That is, amazingly enough.
Pretty much true to fact.
Well, there's not too much to exaggerate on it, because it's pretty pretty ridiculous in and of itself.
Pretty good. Although I had heard that it was an island, so I'm a little reassured to know that it was.
Right. I'm sure. I had heard that it was an island, too.
So, did this story keep coming back to you? Did everybody know that you were the star?
Most people knew at least that year and the year to come. Most people knew. When I started finding out from people that didn't know, or that you're that guy, was when I was like a senior, which is 2 years later. And, you know, freshmen might have heard that story and been like, oh, my God, yeah, I can't believe it, blah, 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 going on. And then I also heard it from a couple of alumni who came back for alumni weekend, and they were like, you know, we heard this great story, you know, about this happening and, you know, stuff like that. So it did come back, but it came back in ways that I guess I didn't really see it coming back. Most people pretty much knew then and there and, you know, would say something about it at a party or on the hill or something. To that effect.
Right, now does something like this, that's a wonderful story, does something like this stay at the student level, or did the administration get wind of it?
We actually had some talk from some of the IFC members who and the faculty who were on the IFC saying that, you know, fraternity activities should have been kept on the fraternity level, because in the sense that they didn't want to hear anything more than they had heard, which is, you know, obviously the rest, anything else that might have happened was, you know, within fraternity bounds. And so we usually don't share that many things, you know, details and whatnot. But they had said that, you know, they usually like to keep things off the hill, and the fact that they got me from the hill, and, you know, obviously I'm sure some teachers and stuff saw that, thinking, why would they want to kidnap someone? You know, what's going on there? What are they doing? What are they going to do to that poor boy and stuff like that? So I think they had cause for concern in that sense. But other than that, it like I said, it's something that had been done. It's been done very innocently, you know, and I mean, you know, there aren't hazards to your health and whatnot there and things going on in that sense. Although with being blindfolded, you and I think that was the whole purpose of that. You'll say there are very many mind twists that they can do, which makes you think that there's a lot more danger there than there is. But so essentially they really didn't, you know, it's something that other fraternities I know do as well. And it's not something that's like seen as abusive of the freshmen, which, you know, I know fraternities have been accused of and had problems with in the past. So there really wasn't that big of a turmoil made about that. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they knew about it, but I also wouldn't be surprised if from both angles. One, why would they want to do something like that, you know? And the other one, no, it's just tradition. So,
you know, one thing that they keep mumbling about, talking about seriously, is the idea of hazing.
Mm-hmm.
Would something like this be considered by them to be hazing?
I could see it very easily, but I could see them approaching it from this angle, not that it was hazing by the upperclassmen, but that the freshmen were doing this as a result, if you will, of the hazing that they had received. Like, this is their chance to kind of get back. And why would they want to get back if they had never been hazed in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, that's, like I said, that's, I think, the traditional aspect is much closer to the truth of it than anything else, just because it's that challenge that everyone kind of builds them up for from, you know, early on. You know, so can you guys top what's been done in previous years? You know, what do you got? And, you know, although if they had pulled it off, they genuinely would have been, you know, lauded as, wow, man, you guys did a great job, you know, blah, blah, blah. But since they didn't, it turned around and that much more on them. And so it was just like, oh, you guys can't do anything right. You know, you have the makings for an incredible story, and it turns out to be an even more credible story, but not in your favor.
Not for you. So. Well, Is this something that is, this isn't just an SAE tradition? This
goes No,
on,
not at all.
And does this go on in other schools, or is this W&L thing?
I've heard it rumored in other schools, but not as much as I have in W&L. And I don't know whether that's just because of my contact with W&L, but I've definitely heard of it happening, you know, at W&L, especially in some of the larger fraternities that have, I guess, that have a more of a tradition of being some of the stronger fraternities in the sense of numbers and tradition and whatnot, some of the older ones. But they're, you know, outside, like I said, outside of my own fraternity, there were stories separate from that. I mean, the plain one and some of the other ones were things that I just heard within, but then the one about the guy being taken down to Hollins and stuff like that were from other houses and whatnot. I'd heard stories from about Phi Cap and Phi Delta and KA, I think, as well. So I think they're, I'm not sure if Beta did any, but I definitely heard about stories from those other houses. And a lot of attempts as well, I might add. Those guys were a little more fortunate than me as far as eluding kidnapping.
Well, I think that's just amazing what an audience you had for the whole
thing. Yeah, that just added to it as far as people showing up that night at the party, you know, kind of like wanting to know what was the result of the whole scenario, the whole scene on the hill. So.
Well, Jeff, I want to thank you. That's getting it from the source. We don't often get to the horse's mouth.
No, you're right. You're right. So.
All right. Well, now I'm going to back up. That was the unique story that only you could tell. Now
okay.
I'm going to back up and do some of my usual questions.
Oh, sure, sure.
Which is, first of all, what made you go to Washington and Lee? Why did you choose W&L?
I really had the first exposure I had to it at all. Coming from New Orleans was one of my sister's friends. My sister's about 3 years older than I am. And a girlfriend of hers who I actually had known very well from when we were younger had gone to a place called W&L, and I knew she was pretty intelligent and that she had nothing but good things to say about it. So I did a little more talking about it and research and found out that there were a lot of my parents' friends. And that kind of led me to realize that there was a rather large W&L community from New Orleans, alumni community from New Orleans. And went up to visit a bunch of schools. I applied to like 10 different schools, all pretty much in this area, from Boston on down to, I guess the most southern place was, I guess, Vanderbilt in Tennessee. And got invited up for one of the scholar weekends or something to that effect, which is a whole other story. But had by far and away the best time. It was a St. Patrick's Day weekend that just happened to coincide. And it had by far and away the best time at W&L. I went to three different other schools. Went to Georgetown, Tufts, and I think Boston College, and checked out their whole weekends and what they had to offer. And none of them could compare. A lot of people question my going to a small college in a small town. And I had absolutely no hesitation coming from such a big city with so many big city problems and being exposed to those in a pretty relatively large high school. So, you know, having so many good experiences there and knowing that they had a pretty good commerce school as well, which is what I was interested in, and knowing that they had a lot of tradition, was really a big draw for me. So.
And St. Patrick's Day didn't hurt at all, I'm
it
sure.
It did not. It did not. It happened to be a very memorable weekend. It was actually the first weekend I think that I ever had grain alcohol. So, and it didn't take much, but I had a really good time. It was fun.
So you mentioned you came for the Scholars Weekend?
It was actually the people who had just missed the Scholars, I think. So the Scholars came the weekend before us. We might have all come, and then they let us know what the results were. And they said that, you know, I think we had just missed it or something to that effect. Do they still have the University Scholar Program? Where they give away the scholarships to freshmen coming in?
I think
and if they maintain a certain GPA, I think they, yeah.
I think
so. I didn't receive it, but that was just what the weekend was for.
But you said there's another whole story there.
Oh, it was just with getting. I got pretty inebriated and was staying with a host as a freshman, who's a freshman in the freshman dorms, and I went there and he had actually gone out of town for the weekend, so he wasn't too much of a host, and I got rather sick that evening after I'd gone to bed, and. Had tried to clean everything up, but I had a flight that I had to catch at about 6:00. I had to leave about 6:30 to catch, and so I didn't realize that I had made a mess until about 5, so I had only like 10 minutes to clean up. Cleaned up, turned on the fan, opened up all the doors and windows, and his next-door neighbor, you know, who I had actually become really good friends with then and there because he played on the soccer team, and I was interested. I had met with soccer coach and stuff that weekend because that was another reason why I was going to WNL was to play soccer for what ended up being just a couple of years. But he and the other guy had kind of a rib going on, and so he laughed at me and had seen that the guy's room still probably didn't smell very well and hadn't been thoroughly 100% clean, so he closed the door, turned off the fan, and turned up the heat. So that by the time the guy got back 2 days later, his room was just a mess. And I didn't see this guy again until I was coming through Rush, the freshman whose room it was, until I was coming through Rush my freshman year. And it was such a conversation piece at that fraternity that he was actually a Pi Phi. And I knew a bunch of them from soccer as well. And they've all found that out real quickly as well. And he, you know, started off by saying, I can't believe you think about coming back here after what you did to my room and whatnot. But it ended up being, like I said, a great conversation piece. And I actually got along with those guys really well. So
that was another whole story.
Yeah. Yeah. And there were actually even guys who were tied into it. It's getting pretty disgusting now, but I've started, so I guess I can't stop. But guys in his fraternity who came back to check on him that night, as far as, you know, saying, you know, come on with us, we're going to go get some food or something like that, I'm sure, just to mess around with him and wake him up. And they came in, and actually one of them slid around and fell in what I had left, and he was one of the guys on the soccer team. So when he found out that this, you know, new goalie of his was a part to this, it was pretty embarrassing. Only one of the few times, actually, that I've ever gotten sick from such a thing. But surprisingly enough, I recovered and put all that aside and realized at the time I'd had before any of the alcohol was involved was definitely one of the more enjoyable weekends that I'd had. So
you were a C school major?
Yes, I sure was.
Were there any teachers who made a real difference for you?
One teacher, I guess, was Goldsmith, who was a really charismatic guy. I'm not sure if he's still there. He might have left. He was a really incredible teacher, very, very energetic, you know, very unique for a C-school teacher because of his energy about the whole thing and his unorthodox styles of teaching. And he was a really good first-year guy to have as a freshman. I came back my freshman year, and he was still my advisor, and he said, you know, so how'd your summer go? And I told him I'd worked in an accounting department and that the business aspect, the whole business aspect of a company appealed to me more than just economics with the theory behind it. And so he did a pretty big thing right then there. He's like, all right, well, let's go find you a new an accounting or business advisor. So he took me next door. He's like, let me introduce you to my good buddy, Bill King. And Dr. King kind of pretty much molded me and pushed me in the direction that I've taken. He was big influence by identifying and kind of taking me under his wing early on. And I give a lot of my credit to my success to his really kind of watching out for him and giving me a lot of credit, which sometimes I felt wasn't always necessarily, you know, due. But he also made some very good suggestions when it came down to my senior year and in choosing places to work. He gave me some very good advice about that, whether or not to go into public accounting, which is what I'm in now. And if so, with whom? And if so, also in what areas to focus in. Mm-hmm. So definitely a unique experience. You know, never forget him. And is very different from what I hear from my other friends and family, even my siblings and whatnot, and their experiences at with their faculty. I mean, if they got lucky to see him once a semester, they consider themselves fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
really?
And I'd stop by to see Dr. King at least once a week, if not more, in addition to the fact that I had him pretty much for a class almost every semester for my last 3 years. So.
The personal touch?
Yes, the personal touch.
How about those experiences that are uniquely Washington and Lee? Did you get involved in mock convention?
Well, no, because I was a freshman when mock convention rolled around.
Uh-huh.
And the only way we got involved in it was as pledges and building a bunch of floats for the seniors and juniors who became delegation heads.
Uh-huh.
And I think we built Alaska, which was really funny. And I wasn't even, I was on Kentucky because one of the seniors needed a bunch of bodies on his group to help make calls, on his delegation to help make calls to get money. And then another senior said, you know, I need you to help come build my float. And then another senior said, come help build mine and, you know, help drive it and ride on it with me. We need more bodies to ride on it. And so I ended up riding on the Alaska float. We had a Jeep with a big stuffed moose head on the front of it. And we had pretty much just done it the night before and put cotton over the entire float. It was a bed, a trailer bed that was probably, that we were towing behind the Jeep, it was probably like 15 feet by like 10 feet. And there was a big old barbershop kind of candy cane going right in the middle. There's a sign on it saying North Pole pointing that way, New York pointing that way. And they put a sled on it with a bunch of Christmas presents wrapped up. And then they put a couple of the fraternity dogs leased onto the sled, you know, just sitting there on surrounded by all this cotton. And the dogs were, one of them was like a little hot dog, a tiny little dog, another one was a basset hound, so really good comic.
Your basic sled dog.
Exactly.
Right?
And then on top of that, they dressed up in earmuffs, mittens, and coats, and they had three or four of the more, definitely I'd say more the renowned for their looks, women renowned for their looks from WNL's student body, who they all happen to be pretty good friends with, and they were wearing bikinis with, you know, snow boots and earmuffs and mittens and stuff like that, and throwing the candy off and playing music and driving along. It was pretty fun. It was. But other than that, I didn't get this. I stayed pretty involved my freshman year, encompassed by soccer, which took a lot of time. I kind of used it as an excuse, I guess, in a sense that, you know, because it did take up so much time. Mm-hmm. And I realized that. So I stopped playing soccer my junior year and started getting involved in other aspects. Got elected to house office and then became president of SAE my senior year. And just joined a bunch of different clubs on campus and stuff.
What kind of club?
I was on a couple commerce school clubs. One was like the commerce student body of consultants, which didn't really take off that much. We were supposed to volunteer what little classroom knowledge we had for local merchants. And then I was on a student board of advisors for the Commerce School, where we would meet with the board members who, I guess, dealt with the Commerce School, I think, once a quarter.
The Board of Trustees?
The Board of Trustees.
Uh-huh.
And they would ask us questions, and we'd ask them questions. And one of them was really interesting because they critiqued our resumes for it. We all brought resumes, and they just passed them around. And, you know, got up front and said, all right, you know, look at this one. You know, this should be better, this should be better. Don't ever do this, you know, try to do this.
Oh, such that's and valuable. Such.
So yeah, it was. It was definitely pretty valuable. Yeah. Enjoyed that. And then it was, I tried to stay really involved in IFC, especially as president, and it was tough my senior year to see things change, see some really huge change be pushed through, kind of like I had known had been pushed through the year before my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
How we had moved 4 years before I was the first year
mm-hmm.
that had, tape okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was the first year that had the winter pledship, where you're going to have fall rush, which was kind of the compromise that the faculty on the student affairs committee, can't remember which student board made those decisions. It wasn't a student board, I'm sorry, it was the faculty board that had two or three students on it, and they made those decisions. And so that was a huge change, as we were told when we came in. And then my senior year, they pushed through a change to take effect this year, in 96, where they were pushing fall rush back to the winter. So they had winter rush and then winter pledgeship. And in the process, they had restricted the time constraints and pretty much restricted. Rush was cut down to 2 weeks, I think, from, you know, 5 or 6 weeks. And pledgeship was cut down, I think, to 10 weeks from 12 weeks to prior to that, like 20 weeks or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just frustrating. I kind of left with at least having such a good feeling about the student governing that went on there with the honor council, and the fact that we, you know, were able to uphold that on our own. and you were being judged by a group of your peers. It got pretty frustrating to see all of a sudden, no matter how strongly we, you know, there wasn't a single fraternity that was in favor of this, and we made some really good arguments about in favor of this and how we could change it, but they kind of had their own mindset, and so we had to change it for what we all felt was the worst. One of their main arguments was that the freshmen didn't have time to get to know the fraternities on their own through Rush in the first semester, that they needed a whole semester open contact prior to that, and that they were afraid that the freshmen's grades suffered too much first semester because of Rush. And if Rush only lasted six weeks, and this open contact lasted the whole semester, and you felt a lot more pressure to get out and get to know people, then, you know, we failed to see the difference that would have on the grades that much. But that, and then also the sophomores having to live on campus now, you know, that's a big change. I mean, handing down, going from, in fraternities especially, I know it happened in a lot of sororities too. It was, your sophomore classes were all usually the same size, and you'd have seven, 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 or two, you know, mixed up groups that would go to, from that house that would kind of take over houses from other upperclassmen that had been in the fraternity, you know, that people had stayed in and had parties at and whatnot and had traditions of their own for years and years and years. I think we've had Windfall for over 25, 30 years, if not more. And, you know, that's been hurt by this whole process for girls especially, I think. Guys aren't hurt by it because most of them have to live in the fraternities anyway, I think, because that's considered university housing. But all the girls' houses, they all now have to live in Gaines, of all places, which when I was there had such a stigma. It's pretty funny.
What kind of stigma?
Just as being the place to live when you didn't have anywhere else to live. Because, number one, you have to keep in mind, coming from someone who is very in favor and very pro-fraternity and whatnot, but if you didn't belong to a fraternity, 9 times out of 10, your sophomore and or junior, senior year, you would live there. It wasn't always the case, but a lot of the people there usually didn't live in fraternities. And, you know, there were so many open rooms, and you still had the constraints of living in university housing. So it wasn't the freedom, I guess, that you had, and even in a sense the responsibility that you had of living on your own and getting, you know, paying all the bills on time and whatnot. Stuff like that.
Now, where is Windfall?
It is, I'm not even sure if it's in Rockbridge or in the city. I think it's right past the county line, and it's out, if you're heading over the Maury River and East Lex is on your right, you take a left on that road right there that heads out along the Maury River.
Mm-hmm.
And it's right up by Shainer's Greenhouse, mm-hmm. in that area, right back behind where the prison is, Rockbridge County Prison, I think. And it's an old farmhouse that's on a big plot of land that Shainer actually ropes off and has cattle grazing all around. So it's, like I said, it's been in the house for a long time. It's really beat up. I was president, so I didn't get the opportunity to live there, but, it was... It definitely had the reputation of being one of the in places to live for guys within our house.
And it's so convenient to East Lex.
Quite convenient to East Lex.
I'm going to turn the tape over.
Sure.